You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast. My name's Chris Parr. Today we're covering the edition that covers the 9th to the 15th of May 2013. I'm joined by reporter and feature writer Matthew Rice, news editor Simon Baker, and senior reporter and deputy features editor Paul Jump. Matthew, we'll be looking at your feature on the life and times of sorority students at US universities. Paul's splash on a new allegiance of five universities that's to be known as the Science and Engineering South Consortium. We'll also be looking at where David Willetts and Vince Cable decide to go when they visit HE institutions. Do they prefer Russell Group universities or post-1992s? Well, I'm sure you can have a guess at the answer to that, but we'll take a look at the facts later on. But to kick us off, Matthew, your feature, I notice, is illustrated this week with a screenshot from Sorority Row, one of your favourite films. Is that why you went for that?
That is absolutely right, yes, yes, yes.
No, what's it about?
Well, it's based on a book by two American academics called Paying for the Party. And basically they went underground, perhaps I could say. They lived in a dormitory on a sorority in an unnamed university which was famous for its party scene. It was a party college, and indeed in a party dormitory. And what they look at is the way the sororities, they're very, very hierarchical. It's absolutely obvious which sorority people want to be in. And they're totally self-selecting. So you get, year after year, you get the same sort of people. And they're all blonde, bubbly, heterosexual, more or less naturally blonde, I should say, and all sort of au fait with the right kinds of handbags and shoes and so on. And there have been lawsuits about sororities, that they exclude on the grounds of race and class. But they're very much self-perpetuating in terms of class. This is the point. And these young women come to universities, or this particular university, primed to party, and they take easy majors in things like sports, recreation, management, and so on, classes are not held on Fridays to enable more partying. And the book is, quite entertaining. It's like reading it, it's sort of watching a teen movie, a lot of it. But the point that they're really making is that for universities, rich students, including rich students without any great academic talent, are a very desirable demographic for them. And that this university is providing this party scene, which works very well for people who want to make rich marriages and going to careers in fashion and broadcasting. But all the other things that universities, perhaps more important, they ought to be doing in terms of social mobility, providing professional qualifications, kind of get squeezed out to some extent.
So the universities are complicit in this, are they? They're arranging their courses around the timetables of some of these sororities, and I imagine fraternities.
Yes. They're very powerful institutions, the sororities, actually, and fraternities even more. They actually own property on campus, and they're kind of part of national network, so they kind of, they're sort of semi-independent. And the great thing about them is that you can drink in a sorority or a fraternity much younger than you can in a bar, so they're very attractive to students in that way.
And but the parents are quite happy to fund this lifestyle, aren't they?
To some extent, yes, they seem to be.
Well, they are, if it means their ticket to success.
Yes,
I see it, I suppose.
Well, I think one of the things they imply is that this kind of system of doing a lot of partying at university makes lots of contacts, but it works very well for socialites who then have parents who can, often with connections for jobs and internships, often will, fund them to go and, move to the metropolis while they're building careers and so on. But for people who are a bit less rich, it's actually probably a very bad path to go down, not because you become an alcoholic or something like that, but because you don't have the social capital which enables you to make the most of it.
Mm. Is there any evidence of this kind of culture growing in the UK? Is that anything you looked at, or is it just purely an American study?
Well, I think it's probably fairly specific to America, because the sorority system and fraternity system is what is very clear is it's incredibly hierarchical. It's absolutely clear which are the ones that people, the top people, want to get into. And obviously you have things like the Bullingdon Club.
I was going to say, probably the closest thing that we really have to something. But I mean, it's a completely different thing in a way, isn't it? I mean, it's such a thing specific to Oxbridge, really, that kind of thing.
Yes, and I think there are probably one or two social clubs which have this kind of status in some elite British universities too.
And of course, you can drink aged 18 in England, so maybe that attraction is
yes, that does make a difference, certainly.
They were well worth a read. Do take a look. The splash this week, Paul, is your piece on a new allegiance. There's quite a few sort of regional allegiances of universities growing up about the place. Why is this one distinctive? What's the concern, and what are the strengths of it?
Well, I think it's, I mean, you're right that this is just you can see this is just the latest of a long line of regional university alliances on the research side, all of which have very similar sounding names, with a letter and a number. We had N8 was the original one, the Northern one, and we had M5 in the Midlands, GW4 in the Southwest. And now we've got SES5, as it's calling itself, so not much imagination there.
Science and Engineering South, I should just reiterate. It's only actually just been announced, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. Just on Thursday, yeah. I suppose what's distinctive about this one is, firstly, who's in. What you've got here is the four biggest research universities in the UK, namely Oxford, Cambridge, Imperial and University College. You've also got Southampton, which is also in the top seven across the UK for research income from the Research Council. So they really are a very, very powerful group, much more so than any of the others. I think the other interesting thing about it is who's out, who's not in it. I mean, this is billed as if this is the latest regional alliance, where's King's College? Where's UEA? Mm-hmm. Where's Sussex? Where's Queen Mary? All of these are obviously large research universities based in the southeast as well, but they're conspicuous by their absence. It seems that the answer to that is really that they're not there more due to accident rather than design. It's just that this alliance has grown out of sort of existing collaboration on things like IT between those five universities. So I think part of the answer is they simply haven't got around to inviting anybody else in.
It's quite a formidable group, though, isn't it? I mean, will it grow? There'll be people looking at that group and thinking, you know, I want to involve myself with institutions of that calibre. Is it a flexible structure, or is that it?
They say that they're open to others joining or others partnering with them in other ways. I think what they've got in mind there is this sort of much mooted hub and spoke model, where you have a sort of central hub of, you know, really big research intensives, and then other spokes that sort of plug into it as and when they can. So it may be that something like that emerges. Mm. Whether anyone else becomes a full member is open to question. Not least because it's based sort of primarily on sort of engineering and physical sciences that not every university in the region is particularly strong in. Those if you look at the figures, those definitely are the five in the region that are the strongest.
I mean, could this sort of spread to other fields, really, or do you think it's going to these kind of groupings are just going to form around the kind of research that requires big, expensive pieces of kit?
Well, that's clearly the driver for these things. That's why the government's interested in pushing this, and that's why the universities are responding. It's hard to see what the rationale would be around humanity, certainly not in terms of saving money. There may be other reasons for it, but you know, when I spoke to these universities, it did seem that very much the driving force for this was about saving money and, you know, responding to the financial climate by sharing their kit rather than having one piece each.
It's good to have a solid example of what they can do. I spoke to David Bell a while back, VC at Reading, and he spoke about them and said, you know, they'd looked at some of the groups growing up around that area and so far hadn't decided to sign up to any purely because there hadn't really been any tangible work. It was great to have allegiances, but what were the actual outcomes of those allegiances? Sounds pretty clear in this case.
Yeah. Well, the theory is pretty clear. Whether much actually transpires in practice is a good question, particularly given the historical rivalries within that group. I mean, is Oxford really going to collaborate with Cambridge to any great extent?
Sabotage the equipment before they send it over, or before people come and use it.
I mean, they insist that they will, of course, and you know, they insist that they're all in it for the UK, and you know, there's a new spirit of collegiality among them. That perhaps that's true. Well, I guess that remains to be seen. I mean, one of the points that the NA make quite strongly is that it took them quite a while really to overcome even the distrust among their senior figures. You know, and obviously there, you know, historically there isn't such a rivalry really between Leeds and Manchester as there is between Oxford and Cambridge. But it took them years, and they said it only became functional, the NA, you know, when that trust had built up. So likely to take some time, I think, before the Southeastern one takes off.
Just so, can I just make a completely flippant aside about this as well? Is it?
Go ahead.
I mean, it's what's kind of quite curious about these groupings is their strange names made up of some of them look like motorways, almost the M5 group being the most obvious example. I just wondered if maybe there was there could be a grouping soon of struggling universities called the SOS 10 or something.
More than 10, isn't it?
I plug that number out of thin air, Paul, but you obviously have got more information than me. But no, it's a certainly interesting move now, because it seems to have sewn up pretty much all parts of England anyway. And I should say that the GW group does include Cardiff as well.
Yes,
so,
yes, indeed it does.
Yeah.
But no, quite an interesting group to watch how and what it does in the weeks to come. But one thing's for sure, those institutions of that calibre probably can expect to be receiving a visit from some government representatives at some point. Simon, this is a story by John Morgan this week that you as news editor to put quite high up on the billing. What's Sidhull about? I asked the question earlier, Willetts and Cable more likely to visit Russell Group universities or post-92s?
Well, I don't know if likely is the right word, or whether they prefer them. I mean, basically, there's been a quite interesting parliamentary question to the business department about how many universities Mr. Willetts and Mr. Cable have visited since the coalition came to power in 2010. We had a breakdown in the answer to this question on which universities they went to according to Mission Group.
Right.
Which was quite revealing, or maybe it wasn't so revealing, because you probably would expect the ministers representing the university sector to go to maybe the country's most well-known universities. But David Willetts went to 100% of the English Russell Group institutions, basically all 20 of those in England, while Vince Cable visited a large proportion of Russell Group universities, 35% of the English members, whereas he didn't go to any million-plus universities at all. Obviously this has kind of angered some of the other groups, like University Alliance. Libby Hackett, chief executive there, saying that this is rather disappointing, really, that they don't get a full view of the sector, they don't go to these other universities. The business department for the government sort of argues that, well, if you just take the Russell Group on their own versus all the other universities, they've been to more other universities.
Mm.
And the Russell Group is a small kind of set of the overall picture in the country. But, I think you can read in some interesting things into... But,
to be fair, though, I mean, clearly they've got teaching, they worry about teaching budget as well. But to the extent that they're worried about the research budget,
yeah,
you would think that
that's
the
why
major
I think it's to be expected.
Yeah,
I think that is why it's to be expected, when you think that they're the major research intensives, and certainly internationally, when a lot of their work is about getting investment into the UK as well, they are going to want to have more contact with those universities to a certain extent. So I don't think it's surprising. But, you know, for the number of students those other universities cater for, really, then you would think they would need to be up to speed with what's going on at those other universities, especially since they're training people in quite important vocational areas like teaching, nursing and others as well.
Absolutely. Well, all of those stories are out now on our website and in hard copy. I should flag up one other interesting story from an international perspective, I should say. Singapore has become the first Asian country to break into the top 10 of national higher education systems, according to the second annual Universitas 21 rankings. We should at that point flag up that Times Higher Education's own World Academic Summit will in fact be held in Singapore on the 2nd to the 4th of October this year. You can get more information on that at www.theworldacademicsummit.com, so do take a look. In the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Google+, at www.timeshighereducation.co.uk. But until next week, that's the end of the Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.